This is From the Bookshelves of Forbes India. I'm Divya Shekhar. Our episode today is going to be a masterclass on how to innovate, build companies, build products that change the world, and how to learn and persevere despite failures. Our guest on the podcast is Tony Fadell, who is possibly one of the greatest product designers in the world today. You'll definitely be familiar with the products he's designed if you've ever used an iPhone or an iPod. He's had successful stints at General Magic and as the CTO of Philips, and has also set up Nest Labs and launched the Nest Thermostat, which was bought by Google for $3.2 billion in 2014. Fadell is an inventor, entrepreneur, investor, mentor, and now an author. With his new book, Build: An Unorthodox Guide to Making Things Worth Making, Fadell, who is the co-creator of the iPhone and has led the team that built the first iPod at Apple, shares leadership and life lessons that will hopefully help you take risks, learn, and think differently about solving for some of the world's most pressing problems. Welcome to the podcast, Tony.
Thank you so much, Divya. It's great to be here. Looking forward to your questions.
So when I started reading your book, it seemed to me some sort of a guide for, you know, youngsters who would want to start out and who would have questions about, say, how to navigate their career path, how to stay on course in the face of challenges, and basically how to figure out their place in the world. But was that your intention as well? Like, what was your intention when you started writing this book?
Well, that's a great question. So I had been approached for many, many years to write a book. So this was something I thought of for about 15 years, because I didn't just want to write an autobiography, or a tell-all gossip book or anything like that. I wanted to really honor the mentors who helped me get to this point. And so this was really an encyclopedia of mentorship. It's the things that I've learned from the people who helped me at the hardest times in my career. It's the things that most people won't talk about. And so I wrote this book for a lot of different people who are trying to build themselves, build their career, build a product team, a company, what have you.
We'll speak about mentorship in detail, in the conversation in some time. But right now, I mean, you've had the opportunity to work with both Apple co-founder Steve Jobs and Google co-founder Larry Page. And I'm sure you must have been asked this question a lot of times. But for our listeners, could you talk about, say, their leadership styles, their mentorship styles, and sort of your experience of working with them through that time?
Sure. Larry and Steve. So Steve was an incredible marketer. He was an incredible salesman to a certain extent. But what he really understood was the customer and got in the mind of the customer and really was empathetic with what the customer would need and want to try to give them superpowers. So while Steve early on his career tried to be an engineer, he wasn't an engineer or truly a designer per se in terms of the physical sense. But when it came to understanding and empathizing with the customer and the customer journey and how to communicate that, he was an absolute master. And then I contrast that with Larry. Larry Page is really, he came from science and research. So he was very much, and he still is, very much from the part of what's the basic science? Where can we go with first principles? How to push the edge from a research and science perspective? So, but he wasn't necessarily an engineer either. So you have two sets of people on very different ends of the spectrum. One, a master marketeer and storyteller, and the other one, a really feet both planted in R&D, research and design and science.
I'd also now like to speak about different stages of your professional life, and starting with one of the stories from the book that has stayed with me is the time that you made the Sony Magic Link in the 1990s. The $800 device that had a phone, touchscreen, email, you could book your plane tickets on it, it had emojis, etc. Something like you say in the book, something like an iPhone, but it was a failure and no one bought it. So could you tell us in some detail why that happened and why the iPhone that came later on the other hand was hugely successful?
Sure, no problem. Well, look, what I've come to learn through these years is that you may have the right vision, but you also have to have the right timing. So at General Magic, we were making the iPhone 15 years too early. And the reason being was that both technology and society wasn't ready for it. And so there was a whole movie about the failure. It's called General Magic, the movie. I suggest all the listeners tune into that because it is an incredible story. We can't get into all the details today, but definitely watch that. And so what we were doing at General Magic was envisioning the future, as you said, with email and mobile communications and downloadable games and emojis and these things. And what we were doing was we were creating something to impress us. We were like, this is going to be the future. We need to impress us, the geeks that were sitting next to each other. When we finally shipped, and we shipped just when the internet started. So we were designing this pre-internet. So no one knew what the internet was. No one was doing downloadable games or online music or booking travel. There were no mobile networks, no mobile data networks at all, but there were hardly anybody had mobile phones. And most people weren't even moving around if they had a computer at all. If they had a computer, it was on their desk. They didn't have a laptop because laptops were expensive. So what we were trying to solve were problems that we knew would be problems in the future. We didn't even have those problems. I never even had a mobile phone. Most people on the team didn't have mobile phones. So the vision was right, but the technology wasn't there, and ultimately society wasn't ready for it because it didn't even understand the pains we were trying to solve. If you fast forward 15 years later, when the iPhone was shipped, what were the three things? One, that society understood. One, they were carrying around a mobile phone. Many people were. They were carrying around a mobile entertainment device, like an iPod that was playing music and videos. And the other thing, they were carrying around a laptop for productivity and browsing the web and information. So if you put those three things together and people understood those problems, the iPhone shows up, which is a combination of all of those, and the people who had those things, instead of lugging around all this stuff in their bags and all the chargers and the batteries and cables, they could bring one phone and they could go anywhere and hook to Wi-Fi, right? And or mobile communications networks. That's what the difference was. We had the right vision at General Magic. We just didn't have the right societal and technology timing to make it all come together like it did around the iPhone. And that's why it became a major hit.
You write that you should never kill yourself for your job, and no job should ever expect that of you. But that's something that you've often done at the course of your career, right? Like you say, stay late, come in early, work over the weekends and holidays, miss out on family time. So how does one navigate this?
Okay. Well, we've heard this whole thing about work-life balance, which is I'm going to work 40 hours a week or whatever it is, 50 hours a week, and then I'm going to just be out. That work-life balance isn't that. What work-life balance really means is there's certain times when work is the highest priority and there's life is the highest priority outside of work, and you switch those. It doesn't mean you're going to work all the time for months on end with endlessly, but it also doesn't mean you're going to have work-life balance 40 hours a week endlessly either. You need to know when you step on the gas and step on the brake and go between them, because to really focus and do great things in life or to do great things in work requires focus on either side. You can't do both, obviously, at the same time, but you have to be able to know when is when and modulate between them. Now, I'm not saying that it's just one weekend. You might have to work 4, 5, 6 weeks in a row really, really hard to get something done, but it doesn't mean that you can back off and then not work for 6 weeks and, you know, what have you. You're going to go back to a 40 or 50 hour week. So you have to find that balance. But do not just burn yourself out 90, 100 hours a week. I did that at General Magic. You can see it in the movie. And I really was unhealthy socially, mentally, physically, because I was throwing everything else away. And what you learn is that you have to strike that right balance. But what you also learn is that when you have these life experiences outside of work, those can inform and influence you and help you be a better person at work if you're doing things, not just sitting around and going to a sporting game, but going out and going to the world and visiting different countries, learning about those countries, being curious about other things, and doing things that you can bring back into work that are valuable again to make you more valuable at the job you do or make it easier for the job you do.
Coming to the call that you got from Apple and, you know, how you started building the iPod, you designed the first iPod in 10 months. Could you describe what the process was like during those 10 months?
So how did the whole iPod project begin? It began when I got a call to ask to consult for, at that time, 6 to 7 weeks to put together, after I signed a huge NDA and, you know, gave away my firstborn and all that stuff, to create what would become the iPod. At the time, it was just 6 months after Apple bought a product, a company called SoundJam. It was the precursor to iTunes. Jeff Robin was the founder. Steve bought that company and turned SoundJam with Jeff into iTunes. They were trying to create, trying to connect MP3 players at the time. Obviously, the iPod wasn't the first MP3 player. There were other MP3 players out there. They were trying to connect iTunes to it because iTunes was such a success on the Macintosh. So they wanted to take music on the go instead of just burning CDs. And they tried all these different MP3 players. They weren't working. They were either slow to transfer songs. They had bad battery life. They only held a CD's worth, 15 songs on a thing. Or if they held 500, 1,000 songs, they were really big and bulky. So my job was to come in, and I had already been working on MP3s and digital music products for 3 years at that point. At Philips, the team and I created two products, Velo and Nino, which were the very first products to ever have audiobooks on them. We had Audible audiobooks, the first hardware products to take audiobooks on the go. And during that time, I was like, oh, you don't just have to do audio. What if happens if it's music? And I was a DJ at the time. So why don't we put music on these handheld devices? So I got very curious. So I'd been working on MP3s for about 3 years, doing handheld products. Then Apple said, can we take iTunes on the go with an Apple designed MP3 player? And so I took that knowledge combined with what Apple wanted to do. And over the course of 6-7 weeks, create the basic technology, or found the basic technology and building blocks, put them together, the screens, the displays, the user interface, the form factor, the connectivity, presented that in a model and a business plan and an outline of all the features to Steve Jobs in March, end of March of 2001, and then worked incredibly hard over that spring and summer and early fall to then show the product at the end of October of 2001, and then had the first ones for shipping in November 2001. So it was an incredible, you know, time. It was very, 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 very fast. It went by in a heartbeat, but it was 3 years of real work, 4 years of real work of researching and understanding MP3 and being at the right place in the right time, getting that call to then put it all together. And the hard drive that was in the iPod was shown in a Japan trade show in January 2001. So there was that small little hard drive. MP3s were taking off. iTunes was happening. And I and my team at Fuse knew a lot about MP3 players and were building them to put them all together to then ultimately ship it, you know, 10 months later. So that's the story. And it was an incredible time because it set the stage for the modern day Apple. Because if there wasn't an iPod, there wouldn't have been an iPhone, most likely. And there wouldn't be the Apple we know it today.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there was also Steve Jobs' idea of building the iPod plus phone, which, like you said, that was the concept that sort of laid the groundwork for the first iPhone later. So, but you also mentioned how at a lot of stages, the team thought that, you know, it's something that cannot happen. So what did it take sort of to keep working on something when the odds sort of seem stacked against you and you felt that, okay, this is something that can't happen?
Sure. Well, at the time, you know, iPod was very successful for Apple, and it started to gain because we already passed the third generation. So Apple was now starting to become a darling. Shareholders were buying more shares, and people were like, oh, maybe Apple has a life in it again. Apple retail started happening. There started to become a buzz. People were waiting in line for new iPods at the time. But during those same years, the mobile phone industry was really gaining traction. People were buying lots and lots of cell phones. And so now what was happening was the cell phone market was growing, and it was hundreds of millions of units a year. iPod was tens of millions of units a year. And the mobile phone guys said, wait a second, we're always on the go. We're in your pocket. We have a processor and a speaker and all these things. Why can't we do digital music and MP3 players? So they were starting to do music. And so we were looking, going, wait a second, iPod is 50% of revenue in certain quarters at Apple. Apple's finally getting there. But if these mobile phone guys steal the iPod because they integrate it into the mobile phone, we may not have a business any longer. And Apple can go back to the way it used to be, you know, and not being successful. So it was an existential crisis. So when you have these big footsteps of these huge mobile phone companies and everybody around the world wanting a mobile phone, which device were they going to carry with them? If they could only carry one device, would they carry their personal entertainment device or would they carry their mobile phone? And obviously it was very, very clear that the communications was meant productivity, which meant you could do business with it. You could do and messaging too. You could do a lot more. And at the same time, that's when BlackBerry was going on, and BlackBerry was very popular and taking off, at least in the professional world, and taking off. So we were in an existential crisis. We were at a crossroads. And that's when we decided we needed to go and address how to make Apple get into the into the mobile phone business. Now, would that be an iPod plus a phone, or would it ultimately become the iPhone that we know it today? And it took 2.5 years to work through different versions of the iPod plus phone concept and also iPhone generations before the first generation to ultimately come out with what we've seen now as the original iPhone. And then obviously 14, 13 generations later, maybe 12, the iPhone is the success that it is.
You know, you've worked, from General Magic to being the CTO of Philips, and you founded Fuse Systems, and then came Apple, Nest, and Google. Is the founder's mentality something you think people are born with, or is it something you can pick up along the way, irrespective of your age?
I think that the mentality to build things is not innate in a person at birth. I think curiosity is, though. So if you're born and you're naturally curious, then that is the drive that you need to learn how to build. So I was naturally curious, but I was also in the right environment supported by my grandfather, who taught me to use tools, taught me to be self-empowered, to understand that the world around us was created by humans and I'm a human and I can go and fix things, make things better, or create from new. So first you have to be curious. That, I believe, is something that's inside you at birth. But then otherwise, you need to be surrounded by environments to help you learn and learn through failure so that you can take that curiosity and harness it and turn it into something. So I think it's a matter of having those two things. And then the third thing is always being up for a challenge. If you're naturally curious and you can get through failure because you see it as learning because you have the right environment around you and you keep going, that's when you can start building bigger and bigger and bigger things because you understand how to manifest things and understand how to trust yourself, even in the face of failure, to persevere through the failure, to learn, to then create again, to then hopefully find success.
What's the toughest product that you have built, and what is the one product that you wished you had built?
The toughest product I built is not a product per se. It's a product at a company, which was Nest. So Nest was all about designing an award-winning and an amazing product, but it was also about building a customer journey, building a full company, building all the marketing, the sales, everything without the resources of an Apple or large company. That was the most rewarding, the biggest thing that I've ever been able to build. I built it with a partner, Matt Rogers, who I couldn't have done Nest without. So that was an amazing experience. And I think that was the biggest challenge I had. But I think the most complicated thing from a design perspective was really the iPhone, because there were so many pieces of that puzzle to bring together, and so many people and so many technologies, that was probably the most complex thing. But the hardest thing to do was definitely Nest, because I was doing so many things outside of my comfort zone and didn't have the resources of something like Apple to be able to just apply to it.
in the book, you write about how if you've ever confused about which step to take next, just figure out what you'd like to learn. It's not about the money or anything else. Is it really that simple?
Well, it's not. You know, I think that it's not supposed to be that simple. You have to, again, start with curiosity and learning and understand your experiences and seeing what experiences you can apply to a new problem you find. That said, and I have this great in the book, and a chapter called Great Ideas Chase You, is because too many times people take what they think is a great idea and just start implementing. They don't really process it and understand all the sales, the marketing, the customers, the virus of doubt, the customer journey, all the things it takes to make sure that they're risk minimizing the thing they're taking on. There's so many things going on when you're building something that you have to look at all of them, especially as a leader, look at them all at the same time. If you don't, you're setting yourself up for a trap, because what you're doing is only doing the things on the idea that you're really good at, as opposed to what you need to do is hire people for the things you're really good at and then start working on the things you're not good at or you're not experienced at to really build out what it is it takes to create a product or a service in the fullness of a business, not just a point product like you see on Kickstarter, but truly a culture, a team, a way of building that can last on generation to generation to generation of products. It takes three generations of a product or a service to create a business. If you do not create that structure around you and you only focus on the product itself, you will not create the culture of the business to allow you to ultimately see success, because it does take multiple versions to work out all of the details. And that's also in the book.
What is your opinion on some of the innovation that's coming out of India? Are there any specific innovations that have caught your attention or you would like to talk about?
Yeah, I've seen amazing things. You know, we're investing in India. We have a company called Future Shape. We advise and invest in over 200 companies directly. And so we've been looking at various startups in India. We've seen incredible innovation in agriculture, ag tech. We've seen fintech or financial technologies. We've seen also drug science. We've seen services, security services. So there are many different things going on in India, solving pains for the local markets. And those local markets are huge. And so I can't, you know, address just one, but I see one company, but there's so much innovation there that I'm very pleased at what I see. And I'm looking forward to investing more time as well as money in the country, because there are so many smart people who have access to so many of the technologies that everyone else has around the world, and actually the access to capital. But necessarily, they might not have all the best mentors or experience. And we think we can bring that value to many of the entrepreneurs in India, and hope we can help those companies serve the people of India, as well as markets in the region, as well as all the way across the planet. So incredibly delighted and great to see the innovation that's coming out of India.
You've mentioned in the book how different stages of your life have seen different versions of you. So my last question to you is, how do you want to chart your legacy here on?
Well, you know, I'm on version 4.0 of myself. And I've seen so many of my friends and colleagues go through different versions of themselves. I'm in version 4.0. And right now I wrote the book because I wanted to give back. I saw most of my mentors had died. And so now what I'm doing through the book is giving back. And so giving back through the book, but also with time and through investments in working with these hundreds of entrepreneurs all around the globe. And I hope to do the same thing for years to come, because I think I learn more and stay young through all of these incredible entrepreneurs and stay fresh and curious. And so that's what I think I'm going to continue to do. Maybe I'll be doing it slightly differently, but I'm having a ball doing it today, and I'm going to continue doing with my Future Shape team. They're an incredible set of people, and you know, talk to me in 5 or 10 years and I'll let you know, and we'll have an update on, you know, what the version 4.0 of Tony Fadell is.
Thank you for your time, Tony. It was wonderful speaking with you.
Thanks, Divya. Have a great, great evening. And thanks for the time. And I look forward to hearing and reading all about this interview.
And to all our listeners, thank you for tuning in. We'd love to hear from you. So do let us know what you think. This is Divya Shekhar. See you next time.